Short people do not like to be picked up.
The Russians are coming. My parents still live in the house we moved into when I was 5. In my old bedroom are the dried flowers from my prom and a street sign I stole when I hung out with some bad kids for a few months. I loved school. I loved new shoes and lunch boxes and sharp pencils. I would hold dance contests in tiny finished basements with my friends. I roller skated in my driveway and walked home from the bus stop on my own. We never locked our door. I had a younger brother whom I loved and also liked. I thought my mother was the most beautiful mother in the world, and my father was a superhero who would always protect me. I wish this feeling for every child on Earth. Because of this safe foundation, I had to create my own drama. I'm aware many children were not afforded that luxury. Some had houses filled with chaos and abuse, and they learned to keep their mouths shut and stay out of trouble. I was dealt 2 loving parents, and they encouraged me to be curious. This safety net, combined with the small drumbeat inside of me, meant I did a lot of really silly things to try to make life seem exciting. Our little town of Burlington, Massachusetts, was quiet and homogeneous, an endless series of small ranch houses on tree-lined streets littered with pine needles. The only thing we feared was the dreaded gypsy moth. Burlington was sleepy, and to a restless young girl like me, it often felt like a ghost town. I yearned for adventure, and I spent a lot of my youth in my own head, creating elaborate fantasies that felt grown-up and life-threatening. The streets and woods around my house were a perfect setting for fake mischief. I would spend all afternoon pretending I had run away, and I had to live on my own. I would bring Toll House cookies and a sweatshirt and try to make a fire. I would sneak outside of our house at dusk with a pair of binoculars and search the streets for murderers. I created scenarios in my head that I always managed to escape from. Kidnap fantasies where I would wriggle free from the ropes. Fire fantasies where I would save my whole family and jump from my window into a snowbank. Drugstore robbery daydreams where I would find a way to connect with the troubled teen and get him to drop the gun. After school, I would eat ravenously and then hop on my pink huffy bike. The bike read Cactus Flower on the side, and as I coasted down the street, I would pretend I was being chased. Riding fast and helmetless, I would look over my shoulder and pick a random car and decide it was filled with Russians. I would pedal furiously up to the edge of the woods and jump off my bike, stashing it in the bushes, and then I would pile leaves on top of me and lie very still, imagining how ridiculous those bad guys would feel when they realized they had walked right past me. This was during the Gorbachev-Reagan years, and our enemies had thick-tongued accents and fur hats.
"Do you see the girl?"
the small and scary boss would say.
"Нет,"
the big and dumb one would answer. I would pretend to wait until they were gone, and then jump out of the leaves to get into the business of delivering the microchip into the hands of Pat Benatar. On long car trips, I would make my little brother Greg pretend he was deaf. While he sat in the back seat of our car, we would communicate in made-up sign language as we sped down the highway in the hopes that a passing car would see us and feel pity for the beautiful family with 2 deaf children. When you have a comfortable and loving middle-class family, sometimes you yearn for a dance on the edge. This can lead to an overactive imagination, but it's also the reason why kids in Montana do meth. My best friend, Carrie Downey, lived a block away. Her house was a much livelier version of mine. Carrie and I met the first day of kindergarten. I was dressed in a cowgirl outfit, which says more about my mother's wonderful acceptance of my weirdness and less about my fashion choices at the time. Remember, this was still the 1970s, a time when teachers wore leotards and corduroys and kissed their boyfriends in front of us. My mother was at home, but Carrie's mom, Ginny, worked. Carrie was a typical latchkey kid, and her house had that exciting Lord of the Flies feeling of being run by children. Carrie had a list of chores and suffered consequences if she didn't do them. I came from a home where my mother would gently suggest that maybe I could pick up my room if I had the chance. Carrie had a police officer dad who slept during the day and was not happy if we woke him up. I had a dad who would snore on the couch as we all stood around him and teased him loudly. Carrie had fierce sisters who punched. I had a brother whom I occasionally argued with. The Downey sisters were a tiny gang. They fascinated me. They would fight hard, wrestling around and pulling hair. They would even challenge me to a fight, occasionally pushing me into the scrum. One time, Carrie's sister threw a set of toenail clippers at her eye, and it drew blood. Blood! So exciting! They would torture each other with big emotional threats, and then they would cry and make up and eat a sandwich. They had each other's backs, even when they were talking behind them. Carrie would come to my house and luxuriate in the calm and the junk food, and I would head over to her house to watch her sisters in action. I would come back from Carrie's house riled up, like I had witnessed some kind of dogfight. I would talk back to my mom and mess up Greg's baseball cards and act like I was a real tough piece of business. My parents would send me to my room, and I would stomp up the stairs, excited to be such a troublemaker. I'd knock over some books, I'd kick a wall, I'd put on my Jane Fonda workout and really feel a burn this time. Even though we had such different families, Carrie and I were a good pair, both freckled and Irish, with a strong belief in justice. We would go out for recess and spend the whole time walking and talking. This is something I still love to do today. I call it walking the beat. I often call my friends and I just tell them to meet me on a New York corner at a certain time. The physical act of walking, combined with the opportunity to look out at the world while you're sharing your thoughts and feelings, is very comforting to me. You are in charge of the route and the amount of eye contact. I guess those days with Carrie was when this started. Anyway, Carrie and I spent most of our fourth grade recess time walking the beat and discussing the important issues of the day. The recent release of the Iranian hostages, the attempted assassination of Pope John Paul II, the fact that Luke technically raped Laura on the dance floor when they first met, but now they were the best couple on General Hospital. One day, a student named Jamie brought a pair of handcuffs to school. I don't remember where he said he got them, but looking back now, it was really odd. Where does a 10-year-old find a pair of handcuffs? This felt like an incident one would file under having older brothers. This was by far the most dangerous thing anyone had ever brought to school, besides the honeycomb full of bees that the beekeeper brought for career day. It's an indication of how truly safe and idyllic my childhood was that the handcuffs didn't scare me. They didn't remind me of one of my relatives being hauled away to jail or anything traumatic like that. They only reminded me of a terrific episode of Hill Street Blues. And they were a pair of handcuffs, not a gun, a homemade bomb, dynamite-infused bath salts, or whatever horrible shit kids have to deal with these days. Carrie and I immediately took them, and we shared a look as we locked them onto our wrists. Carrie discreetly dropped the key to the ground, and then we pretended it was lost. We faked being upset, while a small group of kids gathered around, excited about the idea of handcuffs and lost keys and people being stuck together. The general hubbub turned into real concern once we couldn't actually find the key we had dropped. The recess bell rang, and Carrie and I walked back into the building to find a teacher. We were wrist to wrist, and I could feel our pulses quickening. I was thrilled. The other kids crowded around us as we told the teacher what had happened. "They're stuck together!" they cried. "They'll never get free!" Attempts were made to pull us free, but we'd yell out in fake pain, and the pulling would stop. We were brought over to the sink. Paints and brushes were moved aside, and thick liquid soap was poured on our hands. Our tiny wrists looked like they could easily slide out, but they refused. Teachers became irritated at the thought of sending us home in handcuffs. I loved the attention. I loved acting cool and calm about being handcuffed to my best friend. We became instant celebrities. Eventually, Carrie got nervous about getting in trouble. I spoke quietly and evenly to her about how everything was going to be okay. I made jokes about splitting up the week with each other's families. It was the beginning of what I now think is my natural instinct to try to bring levity and calm to stressful situations. I'm an excellent person to be around if you're having a bad drug trip. You need a balance of humor and pathos mixed with some light massage and occasional distractions. I once helped a now very famous actor cross over while he was on ecstasy by speaking to him softly and then pretending to do magic tricks. I was also on ecstasy at the time. This may have helped my comedy, but it certainly didn't help with my magic. Carrie and I sat in class for what seemed like hours while the teacher huddled to figure out what to do. There was talk of going to the police station. There was even talk of getting a big machine to cut us apart. Then we went back outside to look again and found the key. Carrie was happy because she didn't want her police officer dad to lecture her on handcuff etiquette, but I was so bummed. We rubbed our wrists and talked to everyone on the bus about how scared we had been. We dined out on the great handcuff incident for weeks. The school called us the handcuff girls. which will be my band's name when I become a rock star in my mid-60s. It was the most exciting thing that had ever happened to me up to that point, and it was the perfect kind of scary story that only lasts a few hours and ends up well. As we grew up, Carrie's house remained my comfortable danger zone. We would pile up pillows for fright nights on Fridays when we would watch scary movies and make popcorn in a giant and expensive microwave. We would sit through Friday the 13th and The Thing and A Nightmare on Elm Street while we folded laundry. I have fond memories of cranking up the air conditioning in Carrie's house and then lying under tons of blankets to watch those movies. Her scrappy sisters would snuggle together and her sweet mom Ginny would join us. I would mostly watch through the holes of an afghan, and Ginny would tap my shoulder just before each scary part. I vividly remember watching Carrie and tensing up at the last scene when Amy Irving lays flowers at the grave. Ginny gently sat tapping my shoulder, and I prepared for the inevitable zombie hand bursting out of the dirt and the chorus of screams that followed. Once middle school rolled around, Carrie went to Catholic school while I stayed in our public school. She wore a uniform and became proficient with black eyeliner. Older kids meant more chaos, and my school suddenly had the energy and excitement I was looking for. It also started to teach me that there were kids who truly weren't loved or happy. And even though most of us lived in the same detached homes with wall-to-wall carpet, inside those homes were drunk moms and mean dads. And the danger I was looking for started to become a little more real. There was a fight in our school every day. Students rushed to the parking lot or the hallway when a fight was starting. Cops broke up parties, and boys got drunk and started to smash their bodies into each other. Steroids were a big drug for a lot of the high school boys in my town, and this produced a weird collection of rage-filled football players who were just as bored as I was. The difference was when I was bored, I would listen to my Walkman and pretend I was in a music video. When they were bored, they would beat someone up. Years later, a few of these football players would be arrested for picking up a prostitute near their college campus and raping her. It would be a landmark case of an admitted prostitute and drug addict winning a conviction against a bunch of white men. I watched it on court TV, and I thought about all those boys and the parties they attended in my house. The girls were a tough bunch as well. I was pushed into a locker and punched by a cheerleader. One girl pulled my hair at lunch because she thought I was stuck up. It was bad to be stuck up. It was also bad to be a slut or a prude or a Dexter or a fag. There were no openly gay kids in my high school. My school had a quiet hum of racism and homophobia that kept all of that disclosure far away. Every year, the girls would have a football game called the Powder Puff. The girls would play tackle football on a cold high school field while the boys dressed as cheerleaders and shouted misogynist things at everybody. It was as wonderful as it sounds. I played safety and tried to talk my way out of getting beat up. I saw a girl hike the ball and then just go over and punch someone in the nose. There was so much hate and hairspray flying. Black eyes were common. I started to learn that as much as I chased adventure, I had little interest in the physical pain that came with it. I also realized I didn't like to be scared or out of control. And then Carrie's mom, Ginny, got cancer. Suddenly, the world was small and tight. Our parents could get sick, and our pretend games felt like a million miles away. The inevitability of death became a new nightmare. I don't remember when I first heard of Carrie's mom getting sick, but it was in that way young children receive news, a watered-down fashion that is a combination of investigating and straight-up eavesdropping. I remember her children pleading with her to stop smoking and stealing her cigarettes from her purse and throwing them in the garbage. I remember her daughters spending days lying in her bed with her as her cancer spread from her brain to the rest of her body. I remember their dad and her husband, Mike, seeming very lost, but also very strong. And I also remember my incredible paralysis through the whole thing. All of my practice chasing bad guys did not add up to much. Cancer was too scary and too real, and I wanted the whole thing to go away. I was in high school when Ginny died, and I didn't do a very good job of being there for my friend. I had little experience with death, and I did that classic thing of thinking I should just leave everyone alone and wait for the sad parties to reach out when they needed help. Now that I'm older, life seems full of things to worry about. Sometimes I search for bad news as if reading the details will protect me somehow. I call it tragedy porn. I will fill myself up with every horrible detail about the latest horrible event and then quote it back to people like some bad news know-it-all. Remember that Austrian dad, Joseph Fritzl, who raped his daughter and kept her and her kids in the basement for 24 years? I do, because I spent many nights reading every horrible specific fact about it and talking about it to everyone who would listen, until one day Seth Meyers gently reminded me that I worked at Saturday Night Live and it was a comedy show and maybe I was bumming everybody out. At the end of the year, the update team surprised me with a framed copy of an Entertainment Weekly cover Seth and I had posed for. They had replaced Seth's face with Joseph Frizzle's. I'm smiling and pulling at his tie. This is what it's like to work in comedy. Hilarious and horrifying. Speaking of horrifying, I still troll the internet for terrible stories. I see an awful headline and try not to click it. I often can't believe how hard it is not to read. For a while, I was obsessed with a cable show called I Survived. I was never very interested in the people who were attacked by mountain lions while hiking or the dummies who crashed their single-engine airplanes. Those stories seemed like foolish, risk-taking scenarios I could successfully avoid by never going outside. No, I would watch the horrible pieces on women who had been assaulted and left for dead, first-person accounts of people being attacked by strangers or stabbed by boyfriends. This is the ultimate narcissistic white girl game. I would picture how I would handle the attack differently, or the same. Inevitably, I'd think about my own death, which, next to staring at your face in a magnifying mirror, is probably the worst thing you can do for yourself. The ambulance-chasing aspect combined with the Monday morning quarterbacking of it all is the luxury afforded to those of us left untouched by trauma. Sometimes, I would use these tragedy porn shows to unlock deep feelings, or cut through the numbness. I would read terrible stories to punish myself for my lucky life. Some real deep Irish Catholic shit. Either way, it was all gross and all bad for my health. I remember being depressed after my second boy, Abel, was born. I couldn't lose weight and I couldn't stop working. One evening, Will tried to gently point out that drinking a bottle of wine by myself while I watched Oprah on DVR probably wasn't the best way to feel better. And I remember arguing with him that these shows didn't make me feel sad. They were real. They were emotional. They were what I needed to feel better. Then Oprah's show came on and she announced the topic was African baby rape. I was forced to admit perhaps it was time for a break. Let's not end on African baby rape, or start with it, for that matter. Let's end by pointing out all the positive ways you can scare yourself and feel alive. You can tell someone you love them first. You can try to speak only the truth for a whole week. You can jump out of an airplane or spend Christmas Day all by your lonesome. You can help people who need help and fight real bad guys. You can dance fast or take an improv class or do one of those Iron Man things. Adventure and danger can be good for your heart and soul. Violence and desperation are brutal things to search out. Why search out the horror? It's around us in real ways every day. I'm talking to you, the people who made that movie, The Human Centipede. No more Human Centipede movies, please. No more movies about people's mouths being sewn onto people's butts. The whole idea of making and watching a movie like that makes me want to take a 10-year nap. Having said all this, I would like to pitch some taglines for the inevitable next Human Centipede movie. It all makes sense in the end. From your mouth to God's butt. Run, don't walk, to this movie. Unless you are a human centipede, in that case, crawl. Human centipede? No thank you, please. Reasons we cry on an airplane. Number one, we are a little drunk. Number two, we are a little scared. Number three, we feel lonely, which is different than being alone. Number four, we are missing someone or have just left someone. Number five, we're headed towards our family and can't stand our cousins. Number six, we feel like time is suspended and therefore we can feel real emotion without consequence. Number seven, we look out the windows and see the sky and are reminded of how amazing it is to get into a giant steel bird and not have to die on the trail like our forefathers. Number eight, we have just watched a movie, any movie. Recent movies I've cried to include 21 Jump Street, That's My Boy, The Taking of Pelham 123, and Jackass 2. Number 9, The Pressure. Number 10, The Pressure. Different. Let me ask everyone in the booth here a question. How am I doing so far, guys?
You're doing great.
You're doing great, sweetheart.
I, for one, am enjoying myself.
Thank you.
You're doing great.